good horse, I called you my shiny black bears. To the playhouse of fortune, to take the bright silver and gold you have taken from somebody else. And as we go riding in the dark.
You're listening to episode 564 of Unwelcome Guests, Choosing a Life of Action. I'm Robin Upton. This week we're continuing pretty similar formula to last week, with more of the Gatto interview and then another chapter from Deschooling Society with a bonus reading at the end. One of the main points that Gatto is making is the intergenerational change in patterns of human behaviour engendered by mass compulsion schooling. How did the USA's population, originally, of course, they didn't get to America by following orders, they were a pretty independent bunch, and of necessity survived through their own labor. They had independent livelihoods, strong ties to the local community, life or death ties, and were not accustomed to following orders. How did such a population become the dumbed down, homogenized, predictable population of the United States today, used to taking orders and ready to acquiesce even in the face of trillion-dollar thefts in broad daylight? Lest we focus too much on the USA, I gave a teacher training course last week in which I pointed out that three towers were destroyed on September 11th, 2001, by only two aeroplanes, and that this was a blatantly obvious case of controlled demolition, and that it had even been announced on television by the BBC before it happened. And yes, the audience were pretty surprised to hear that, because none of them recalled that from their memory of those events. But I don't think, perhaps I'm doing them an injustice here, but I don't think anybody was interested enough to do research on the internet about it. Which, you may think, okay, well, as an average member of the public, yeah, that isn't that surprising. Well, if you ever try to explain 9/11 or point out that the truth has not been told to members of the general public, you've probably heard a reply along the lines, well, no, there couldn't be a conspiracy because somebody would have said something by now. We would have heard about it if there was, which you don't have to think about very long to realize is circular logic. Because you're telling somebody something about it and they're saying no, because if there had been a cover-up, somebody would have said something. What they mean is somebody would have said something in print or on television, which it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out, considering how few people control newspapers and television stations, basically saying, I've decided to trust a very small group of people for access to what goes into my mind and what I will think about. Why would anybody make that decision? They don't make it consciously. They make it by default. Well, it's a habit from school, where there is one officially approved voice to be listened to, and if you listen to others, you'll get into trouble. We heard a couple of shows ago, the Amerithrax episode, that the CIA had worked out a policy for using their assets in the media to engender public distrust of ideas of conspiracies. Before they worked that out, conspiracies were well understood to happen and were actively followed by a lot of people. So, did people suddenly get that credulous? I think it's not human nature that's changed, it's human conditioning and people have been subjected to a much more organized and calculated, measured behaviorist program. And I think we've got to bear that in mind whenever we speak to people. How much media exposure have they had? How much schooling? How much have they allowed themselves to be conditioned without even knowing it? And I think it applies to all of us. I mean, even if you've never been to school, but you picked up a newspaper, let's be aware of the insidious effect of social control, amongst which mass compulsion schooling is near the top of the list, perhaps the very top. Now, let's get back to Gatto on that, who's going to shed some light, some parts of the historical record that he has uncovered that you're not going to hear on the television and you're not going to read about in newspapers.
Let's talk about J.P. Morgan, Rockefeller, Carnegie, those kind of fellas.
Okay, let us start with Horace Mann, because he's the patsy and the fall guy. Mann grew up on a farm, and the father had died, and so Mann made straw hats, and he never wanted to see a straw hat again to keep him and his mom alive. But he married well. He married the president of Brown University's daughter, and although he had no interest whatsoever in schools, this is rich, he was approached by wealthy families, railroading families, which was the big corporation of the day, and told that if he could succeed in getting compulsory school laws passed, that he would be given Daniel Webster's seat in Congress. So he was a good speaker, and he was in the state legislature. He set out on a 10-year quest to bring compulsion schooling out of Prussia into the United States. And he succeeded, I believe the year was 1852. But I'm telling you, he had no interest in schools at all, but he was a practical politician and an ambitious straw hat maker. So Mann immediately caught on that what he said or what mothers and fathers said really didn't amount to a hill of beans. It was the great industrialists who were shaping the United States. And if you didn't have an alliance with those people, your personal ambition wasn't going to go very far. So Mann did what he was ordered to do, and then they screwed him. You and I might not think he'd been screwed, but he was exiled out of the civilized world to Western Ohio, or Central Western Ohio, where a utopian colony was being converted into a college called Antioch. Now, it's got a pretty good rep, at least it did when I was in college. But, and yet, in those days, it was just so far off the beaten track that it was like a pension. So Mann died a very bitter man, because when they had used him, they had no more use for him. Now what we were left with was the American tradition of tremendous independence and self-reliance, which was not so easy to deal with. In Massachusetts it was, in New York it was, in the Tidewater. But as soon as you went inland, here were people used to producing everything for themselves or exchanging with their neighbors. Here was this tight, flinty-eyed community of competent people. So you had to begin cutting into that. And that was done by a combination of bribes, from the federal government, legislation that threw advantages to people who played ball and so on. And what was the point of this great transformation? It was that Carnegie, Rockefeller, Astor, Vanderbilt, and maybe a dozen or two dozen other major names.
Like J.P. Morgan, et cetera.
Morgan was he was the banker. Morgan was the leading Episcopalian layman on planet Earth. And why that's important is the State Church of England says in its homily of obedience that God has put us all in our place. It's sort of like Plato. And if you try to get out of your place, you're insulting God. Remember, you have to have a justification to explain to your children so you can live with yourself while you're screwing your neighbors. So Morgan was the only one of those people, by the way, who had had the benefit of at least a partial Prussian education. He had had a year over there, so people came back from Prussia imbued with this idea that people were only machinery, and that if you found the right algorithms, you know, you could make the machinery work efficiently. So Morgan, who had eyes like an approaching express train, I think they were described once. Yes, he was part of the inner circle. And each one of these inner circle people, Morgan included, founded a private boarding school to protect the good breeding stock. Morgan's was Kent, which I think is up in Connecticut. Hotchkiss, who invented the machine gun, was Hotchkiss. And each one of these guys had their own boarding school. The Peabody family, I think, did Groton, which gave us Franklin Delano Roosevelt. Meanwhile, what they wanted was the American population converted from people who wanted an independent livelihood into people who wanted a good job. That was a hard sell, but not if you took their children, you know, 5 years old, and you kept them for 10 or 12 years. Then you created a breach between the parents who remembered what an independent livelihood really meant and the children who had these little prizes dangled in front of them, good job prizes, a raise, a corner office, all the rest of it. And inside of, I would say, three generations, they broke the entrepreneurial spirit of the country and replaced it with a corporate spirit, a corporate government. I mean, one of their great creations was to fool people into thinking that the government represents one interest and the capitalists represent another interest. That is quite untrue. Capitalism could not survive without a gigantic government. The government is the buffer, the flywheel. It represents the people, right? Well, you notice that the current representative of the people quickly passed, I don't know, what was it, $1 trillion to the same bankers who had ruined the country?
Right.
I mean, we are so brainwashed and conditioned. I can't listen to the so-called right-wing talk show hosts anymore because they are so innocent. They are so stupid. They're so brainwashed. They do the work that otherwise...
I couldn't agree more. And of course, somebody up on high is putting those those guys in those positions, like Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and a number of others.
Oh, of course.
They're putting them in those positions because they beckon to the stupidity of the average American that's been brainwashed.
Well, they're riding aggressively on a foundation that's been carefully built for over 100 years now. That, well, we would be gratified if government got smaller, you know, because they balk our efficiency in business. Well, the first Bush presidency, that conservative, tripled the size of government. I mean, these are black and white figures, and the second guy, because he obviously was a stupid man, only doubled the size of government. You know,
right.
But even I was optimistic that someone who spoke so beautifully, who so obviously had been trained in rhetoric, which has been cut out of the public school diet. Expression is something forbidden to.
You're talking about Clinton or Obama?
I'm talking about Obama. You know, I said, you know, there still is a glimmering of hope.
Right.
When his first act in office was to turn the Treasury over to the bankers who had ruined us.
Right. Well, you've stated some things opposed to, like, some of the eugenics theories about what you think that everyone is capable of.
My experience in 30 years in a classroom with about 3,500 assorted 13-year-olds mostly, 12 to 14, from all backgrounds, and classified by the schools, you know, into a whole lot of different categories, is very much like, I think, would have existed as my own point of view several hundred years ago. I think most of these distinctions are nonsense. I don't have much in common with Horace Mann, but his idea that we ought to have common schooling resonates very well with me. Many years I would have elite classes and classes straight out of the ghetto. And if you can overcome the, you know, the superficial distinctions in idiom and background and experience, I didn't find much intellectual difference among those classes, and often I found that street kids who would never get an opportunity in their life, or very unlikely, were superior to the gifted and talented honors kids. Now that is said not cynically, but as an indication of immense problems that exist with institutional schooling, which I think are incurable. It's essentially a business and a jobs project. What nice people who are going about their own lives think romantically about schooling doesn't exist at all. It may exist in teacher A or teacher B, but the business is a business, and it is the largest business in the United States. It grants huge lucrative contracts. It's the largest jobs project if you tie in all the collateral businesses that are necessary to sustain this. It's an immense waste of time and talent. I do think that we could get a lot more value out of everyone by, you know, and unthread this thing is politically murder. Two things that could be done, however, is to remove the compulsion part, since for most of human history, whatever form of schooling existed was voluntary, and to remove the standardization, which is largely monitored by standardized tests. Those things don't correlate with anything you or I or anyone else would find a valuable part of our society, although managers find the obedience that it measures useful to them. But, you know, it's a disgusting racket now.
Tell me about how insulting students is part of the breaking down of the student mentality.
Well, the principle we're tracking is Julius Caesar's wonderful discovery that if you can divide people against their own best interests so that they can't work cooperatively, that the role of management is a breeze. The people are conquered just by being divided. Now, the very first commissioner of American schooling, National Commissioner of Schooling, a fellow named William Torrey Harris, wrote in 1906, and of course this is easily verifiable, that the point of institutional schooling was to turn people against themselves. So he was really quite advanced. The idea of dividing and conquer usually means several parties involved, but to be divided against yourself, self-alienation is the expression he used. That was the point of it, self-alienation, as he said in writing in The Philosophy of Education, published in 1906. He said, "This purpose is best achieved in dark, airless corridors," in other words, in dismal places, and anyone who's passed through the usual public schooling place knows what he's talking about. Now, he was very open about this whole enterprise being to the advantage of management. And as you and I talked about yesterday, the low opinion of ordinary people, the overwhelming mass of ordinary people, the low opinion assigned to them from Plato to Charles Darwin and beyond Darwin too, is what justifies this. If they can be converted into human resources, then you can get, according to this point of view, some value out of them. But if they retain independence, you know, and what, free will, then they're simply a huge annoyance. You know what interests me, and it really intrigues me, is a lot of perfectly respectable people read these things, and I don't know what they're thinking, that the person issuing such a statement as self-alienation being the purpose of schooling, and him being the top dog in the school institution, that, what, is he joking? What is the point of saying that? What is the point of Horace Mann saying we must find a way to break the bonds of association among working men? Do you actually think they didn't mean that? Then why say it? These clues to what the enterprise actually is are everywhere. You know, you don't have to be a conspiracy theorist. For the most part, until very recently, the people doing this were fairly open about what they were up to. It's just, as I said a minute ago, perfectly intelligent people reading these things gloss over them. oh, well, he didn't really mean that, I suppose, is the conclusion. Yes, they do mean that. And the institution has brought this nation to the edge of bankruptcy. Notice I don't use any romantic arguments at all or any moral arguments against this at all. This has destroyed us temporarily. When we got this up and running, it was a tremendous financial boost because we converted our population from an independent, self-reliant group into the most reliable domestic market the planet had ever seen. People willing to mortgage their future and their children's future to buy things and define themselves by what they own. That's corporate paradise, mass production paradise. But the trick was that slowly, incrementally, other nations on the planet, much more prepared to do this, slowly caught on to what we were doing. And they do it infinitely better than we ever are going to be able to do it. Let me just speak of China and India, although we could throw in Malaysia and Japan and probably other nations as well. China produces, through its training system, more engineers than all the rest of the nations of the world put together. According to the Financial Times of London, hardly your radical publication, China bids for construction projects, etc., on the world market at a rate 17% of what American firms bid at. Where exactly are improvements going to lead to a competitive position for us? Now the Financial Times also said that for ordinary single workers, China will deliver very well disciplined, very well trained, reliable workers 30% less than the American training system does. And you and I spoke yesterday that very quietly, without their fellow citizens knowing it, people like Bill Gates lobby relentlessly to open the floodgates to foreign workers. Why not? They get them cheaper. They're more reliable than our workers. I mean, what's not to like from Gates' point of view? And Gates trains them himself on training campuses. And I mean, all this stuff is, again, I don't want to suggest a cabal, but this is quietly overlooked by the newspapers, the popular journals, television. This is something that gentlemen would rather not talk about. It lies at the heart of the capitalist logic, and I am not speaking from a politically adversarial point of view. You buy what you can buy at the very cheapest price, including labor, and you sell it at whatever the market will bear. I mean, this is Adam Smith. It's not Joe Stalin or Karl Marx. We are so untrained to think. I'm talking about very intelligent people, that we simply swallow hook, line, and sinker, as the Rush Limbaughs and the Glenn Becks of the world do, whatever our betters tell us. You know, if I hear the term free market again, I don't think a free market has existed in the United States since I was born in 1935. The market's rigged by enormous subsidies that go to favored businesses. It's rigged in a half dozen other ways, but that way alone would tip the scales. You know, we have so many businesses that actually are bankrupt. They can't compete, but they seem to be able to compete because your tax money and mine gets poured into them in quiet, noticeable ways. And yet we bitch and scream, good God, you're going to give Medicare to somebody who can't get a job? I mean, this is outrageous. Well, it's outrageous that we have an auto industry at all. They have produced such junk for so many years. And it's sweetheart contracts. You know, the police department, the law says they have to buy, I don't know, Fords. Why? They've been junk for 40 years. Why do they have to buy Ford? Because it's just part of this hall of illusion, hall of mirrors, I call it, that our society's become. It's truly disgusting, and it doesn't make the slightest difference whether Republicans have control of Congress or Democrats. They're the same people. Look at their campaign contributions. I mean, sometimes I'm in despair that otherwise intelligent people, finally, when pushed to the wall, have to swallow the worm like a poor fish.
You know what? You had a section in your book, Underground History of American Education, on bell curves. Would you tell us about bell curves and what is the importance of that?
Sure. There's a number of 19th century mathematicians who explored the phenomenon of the bell curve. One is Darwin's first cousin, Francis Galton. Another one's a guy named Gauss, I think. And these are supposed to describe natural distributions of talent or productivity or achievement or whatever. And from the start, from the get-go in any exploration, they do that. What they do not do is uncover the fact that the lower segments of the bell curve are perfectly capable of upsetting the upper segments of the bell curve. We can't allow that to happen because what it would do is stand social class on its head. And social class is one of the reliable ways we organize our society. So the reason you're not allowed to measure the mayor's son or the doctor's son by performance, and instead they're measured by tests of memory like everybody else, these standardized measures, is because even from the get-go, these people often can't compete with ghetto residents. Let me be very specific. It's quite common for street kids at the age of 13, not all of them, of course, but it's quite common for a segment of them to have absolute mastery over public presentation. They're quick on their feet. They're very verbal, you know, and they're not stupid. They have intelligence. Whereas the doctor's son, et cetera, the mayor's son, they're locked into formal presentation modes. They're not flexible. They're not adaptable. And so in half of my teaching career, I ran an intense speech program because I told the kids of the three literacies of speech, writing, and reading, far and away the most important is verbal facility. And no matter what field you're going into, including the sciences, the mute scientists always are exploited by the verbally facile scientists. You know, they take credit for the discoveries of these troglodytes. So I said, we're going to spend a lot of time on your ability to do that, even in front of hostile audiences. What I quickly found was a tremendous discomfort among the kids used to getting A's in English because they could not compete with the ghetto kids, and so their mothers bitterly complained. I don't have the imagination to invent things like that. You've heard the expression, and everyone listening has, self-fulfilling prophecies. Well, the school is set up to certify the social class system and the economic class system that's in place now. That doesn't mean there isn't some variability and some room for upward and downward movement. It means there isn't much that reliably, from decade to decade, you can count pretty much on the same families and the same people being at the top. Now, at that point, they can claim we're biologically superior. Look at the evidence. But the game is rigged, structurally rigged. And the only teachers who can change that are the ones willing to sabotage the system from inside. And doing that is a very, very uncomfortable way to make a living. Although I guess it stabs your conscience. I know I did it for many, many years. It takes every ounce of energy you can muster.
All right, what was the Gary plan?
Okay. When Rockefeller and Carnegie and a handful of others, but those are the two principal villains, when they wanted to import the Prussian system to the United States, well, Rockefeller bought a broken-down college in the Midwest called University of Chicago. It was really called the Chicago Institute, and he converted it into a Prussian university. What that means is that the undergraduates exist for one purpose only, and that's to be the low-paid slaves and serfs of the faculty, which engages in research. Now, a few of the undergraduates earn then their bones that way, and they are put on the fast track. And Rockefeller also bought the Columbia Teachers College and developed it. By 1912, I think, Columbia Teachers College was training 50% of all administrators in the United States, and I think close to 20% of all the certified teachers. So, but setting up the colleges this way wasn't nearly enough. What these architects, let me call them, what these architects of forced schooling were concerned about was fine-tuning the German system so that it could adapt to American cultural mores, so there wouldn't be any flagrant confrontations. So the easiest way to do that was to take a United States Steel Company town in a very, very out-of-the-way location, Gary, Indiana. I mean, it's a town owned lock, stock, and barrel by the U.S. Steel Corporation, and to convert its schools first and then fine-tune them and get them so they could deliver the standardized product that the industrialists wanted at the cheapest possible price. what they thought they could get away with is what they got away with in the mills, which is double shifts. So in the Gary plant, not only was it the Prussian system, but the kids were run in and out of it in a morning shift and then an afternoon shift, and a whole different. So you got double your money out of your physical plant and your teaching staff. When that was considered to be perfected, using the tremendous political clout that Rockefeller and Carnegie had, it was forced onto New York City with no advance debate at all. None of the instruments of democracy were pulled into play. One school year closed, when it opened 2 months, 3 months later, it was the Gary plan. Well, it was the Gary plan. Fortunately, a large contingent of German Jewish mothers who had fled Germany with their kids because they saw that the new schooling institution was about dumbing down their kids, they knew what was going on. They recognized it immediately, and they rioted in the streets. Whatever else people associate with Jewish culture in the United States, street rioting isn't a part of it. And yet they shut the schools of New York City down in 1917. And such a black eye was administered that the mayor, who was the leading candidate for, I don't know whether the Republican or Democratic nomination for president, was forced out of office, which ended his political career. He went to Europe as a pilot in the First World War, and he was shot down and killed. So that's just an interesting little tail on to the story. So now what happened is the Gary plan is balked in New York City, but only for a time. The routine used by sophisticated political architects is, if they can't ram something through by main force, they pull back and wait for a convenient future moment. They keep coming back again and again until, by the 1930s, we de facto had the Gary plan in New York City schools. We only had the split shift in ghetto schools, but essentially we had the dumbed down curriculum of the Prussian design. We had the dumbed down routines, the bells at 40-minute intervals, which were taken straight from Pavlov's experiments with rats. That's the reason we have bells and buzzers and horns. You're conditioning the population to respond viscerally, as you condition a rat to do the same thing. I mean, it's just fascinating. Once you start to wallow in this stuff, you know, it becomes clearer and clearer how, well, I was about to say cynical, but that would imply that the people were looking for venal advantages for themselves. And they were, in fact, utopian thinkers. I mean, Rockefeller and Carnegie and Astor and Harriman, they had all their material wants cared for as far into the future as the family was going to exist. What's the reason for getting up in the morning when you have these titanic resources and powers? Seems to me you have to have an ambition that matches them. So the ambition, as the Rockefeller Foundation announced in 1926, the trouble is announcement doesn't mean they stood with loudspeakers in Times Square. It means that in their house publications and relationships with other powerful people, they announced that their master project was the control of human behavior. That is, the absolute control of human behavior. Not exactly something that you can find in the founding documents, right?
Right.
But it, once again, we're, our biggest enemy is ourselves. We have a population, and including all the intelligent people, who have been conditioned to actually read this stuff, to see it, and to ignore it as if it didn't happen at all.
Well, you know, that's part of the Hegelian dialectic, I suppose. So why don't we start talking about Hegel?
Of course, by the end of the First World War, every single American university that had any reputation was headed by a graduate of a Prussian university. That's how these few specialized German names that everyone's partially familiar with, that's how they spread north, south, east, and west. You know, every government agency was headed by a graduate of a Prussian university, or one from Saxony, or one from Hanover. And this process had started in 1814 with a guy who was eventually to be the governor of Massachusetts. I think his name was William Walker, but don't hold me to that. He went, and then more and more sons of prominent families went. And by the end of the Civil War, it was a flood that continued right through, right up to the time of the First World War. Germany was the intellectual high command of the planet. You know, and the prestige that came with a German PhD, oddly enough, and you'll never meet anyone who knows this, there were only PhD degrees in Prussia and a few of the North German states. You couldn't get one of those in the United States, so you had to go to Prussia to get one. But once the contingent coming back was in charge of enough government agencies and enough universities, then all of them scrambled to get aboard, all the known ones. I mean, the ones with glittering reputations. Hegel fascinated the people who lusted. No, I don't want to use lusted because that would be loading the deck. People whose ambition was to rule the world because they were bored with everything else we could buy it. They were fascinated by Hegel because Hegel taught by the middle of the 19th century that you could take control of human history by provoking crises. Now, that's more important than those two simple words sound, because our 20th century history has been one in which we flared into war, expensive war, because we had been provoked by some military incursion or not. You only have to know Hegel and the influence he had on Germany. Germany provoked the invasion of Poland by murdering its own border guards and dressing some Germans up as Poles, you know, and then saying this is an outrage, we're going to invade Poland. Two naval commissions, U.S. naval commissions, have exonerated, A, the Spanish from having anything to do with blowing up the Maine. It was some drunk who fell asleep and let the boiler pressure build up, or attacking the American destroyers off Korea. I'm astonished. I have never met anyone who's aware of the fact that the high command of the Navy said those attacks never took place. They were an illusion.
Right. Well, that's. I think there has been some documentation of that that's come out in the last few years.
Yeah, but it's on the fringe.
Right.
Right on the fringe. I don't mean that the people on the fringe are fringe people. I mean to keep that out of the mainstream journalistic press, you say, you know, I'm tired of these conspiracy theories. The truth is there's a rather impressive case that the Japanese fleet did not sail from Tokyo Harbor without being tracked every inch of the way. And great efforts being made to provoke Japan into doing that so that we could easily get out of the Depression A, establish bases in the Far East B. I mean, there's a mountain of evidence that's accumulated. And several books, they're diffident, they're a little shy in pushing it to its conclusion, but they do raise this troubling thing that the surprise attack on Pearl Harbor was no surprise. So let's get back to Hegel. If you are a devotee of Hegel, you're not doing this for your personal advantage. You're doing this because you consider your own group to be either biologically or politically or psychologically or whatever so superior that it's your right to take charge of human affairs. Now, you got to get rid of the people who would disagree with you. So you provoke war with them by staging a crisis, and then you shut up the dissidents in your own population. We saw it under, but you know, this is disloyal, this is traitorous to raise any kind of criticism of attacking Iraq. Yeah, I mean, good God, this stuff's been around for 150 years. It's what is taught in seminar courses at Yale and Princeton and Stanford and the University of Chicago and Johns Hopkins, you know, and to run into people, perfectly intelligent people, to whom this sounds like science fiction, is just to... Well, in my case, maybe it's because I'm so old, it's just to get drowned in despair, you know, as if you're talking to children in a crib who've had no experience, who've done no reading, or unaware. Well, it's not going to help us much now, though, to point fingers. This country is in terrible, terrible shape. We lock up six times as many of our citizens as China does. I would say that ought to be headlines. On a monthly basis. Why is that happening? Why is that happening? We don't have a 10% unemployment. The current issue of Atlantic Monthly has a major article saying that joblessness will not recover. There may be a dramatic jump engineered so that the political trouble, but that in fact we're going to permanently run a high unemployment. Right now they say if you count underemployment where people are just you know, shoveling snow or something in order to buy food. They say the unemployment right now is 17.5%. But among men between the ages of 25 and 54, it's 20% and bursting out on the upside. Now we're talking about a number that when I was a boy was considered the precursor to a violent revolution. And yet the Atlantic Monthly says that the psychological effects of long unemployment, it's a catastrophe. The psychological effects are sexual dysfunction, the breakup of marriages, or the marriages being hostile associations, a husband and wife, that are never going to heal, that among kids who graduate into a depressed economy, there is no way for them ever to catch up with kids who graduate into a boom economy. They said the penalty, inflation adjusted, is at least $100,000 tax on these people. That the people who graduate into a depressed economy lose ambition, they cling on to their job like school teachers do, and abandon all principle, they'll do anything you tell them to do. We are in some mess, and nobody knows the way out of this thing. I think we're going to have to go through much worse and reconstitute. I don't know if it's possible, but the political system has to be reconstituted, and that does not mean that it has to be turned over to Republicans. And as far as the group that calls itself conservative, I was one of the founders of the New York State Conservative Party. I left, and I was an officer of the party. I left after 20 years because nobody I met, I thought a sane person would call conservative. They were loonies, wild-eyed radicals, opportunists.
You know, John, I mentioned yesterday that I wrote an article about the definition of conservative, just like the definition of liberal.
I ask you to send me a copy of that.
And the word conservative has been twisted as bad or worse as liberal has.
Yeah, both of them. In fact, the Bush family are classic textbook liberals. Classic textbook liberals.
Well, it's liberal in the traditional sense, liberal means ever befitting the free and for representational forms of government and liberal.
I'll accept that as an alternative definition. But the liberals were people free of any binding obligations or principles. They were liberated. They were able to make it up as they went along to. And there's nothing actually wrong with that. It's just when it becomes a pervasive economic philosophy that you can't trust a liberal because they're liberated from keeping their promises, too. they're liberated from it.
I don't know about that because usually it has to deal with high integrity, whereas a conservative is a preservative, but typically they're only conservative.
What I'm suggesting is, there are a variety of definitions, but the classic definition of liberal, which comes from the British global market, those were the first consistent liberal governments that weren't murdered by their citizens, and they exploited their own citizens in order to build global trade. They exploited the people they concluded alliances with whenever it became convenient to do so. They were liberated from the kind of things that held conventional people back. So economic liberals, and the term exists in the in the late 18th century. It probably exists throughout history in one form or another. But it came about to describe the people who were pouring a fortune into Great Britain because they were playing by their own rules. And the people they dealt with were playing by rather hidebound rules, traditional rules, religious rules, whatever.